Authentic Tibetan Teachings and Transcripts from bodhiarchive.org.
Hidden inside the massive multi-volume Tibetan Buddhist canon is this tiny ancient text, and it holds practically the only explicit scriptural command to do something utterly terrifying. It asks you to take on the suffering of the entire universe. No shield, no protection, just you willingly acting as a lightning rod for the world's pain.
Yeah, it's staggering.
It really is. It doesn't just ask you to be a good person. It asks you to dismantle the very architecture of your ego.
Okay.
So welcome to the deep dive. Today we are exploring a profoundly sacred space. We are intentionally slowing our pace down today, stepping out of the rapid fire noise of the modern world to give you the time to absorb a monumental Dharma teaching.
Thank you for setting that tone. It is a profound responsibility to unpack a text like this with you, because when we encounter ancient scriptures, it's so easy to read them as dry historical artifacts.
Like museum pieces.
Exactly. But the text we are studying today is a living blueprint for a complete psychological and spiritual revolution. And thanks to the extraordinary efforts of the 84,000 Project, which is this amazing global initiative translating the words of the Buddha into modern languages, we can actually hold this jewel in our hands.
Yeah.
In the Degje Kangyur, which is the canonical collection of Tibetan Buddhist scriptures, it is classified as To 286, formerly known as the Dedication Protecting All Beings.
Okay, let's unpack this, because the reason we are dedicating this entire deep dive to a text that spans only a few short pages is, well, because of a secret it holds for practitioners. I mean, the Kangyur is vast. Right?
Unfathomably vast. Thousands and thousands of pages.
Right. And yet, scholars have pointed out that this brief dedication contains what is practically the only explicit scriptural articulation in that entire canon of the central beating heart of Tibetan mind training. It is the canonical seed for that radical wish to literally draw the agony of all sentient beings into yourself. But before we even get to that breathtaking pivot, we really have to look at the physical reality of the text itself. The history of how this reached you is staggering.
It is. We really cannot separate the profound teachings from the lineage of human devotion that preserved them. This text was translated from an Indic language, almost certainly Sanskrit, into Tibetan in the late 8th or early 9th century.
Wow, so that far back.
Yes. And we have the colophon, the historical seal at the end of the manuscript, to thank for this precise knowledge. It records the names of the individuals who actually did this grueling work.
Who were they?
We have the Indian preceptor Vidyukara Prabha, the Tibetan translator Bande Yeshe Ningpo, and the senior editor-translator Bande Paltsek.
Let's actually sit with that for a moment, because I think the modern mind glides right past the word translate.
Oh, absolutely. We picture, you know, Google Translate.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But we are talking of the height of the Tibetan Empire here. You have Indian masters literally walking across the Himalayas, dealing with extreme altitudes, freezing temperatures, rudimentary living conditions, and they're sitting down by an oil lamp with Tibetan scholars.
Yes, exact.
And they weren't just swapping words in a dictionary. They were having to invent Tibetan equivalents for highly evolved Sanskrit philosophical concepts that had been debated in India for a millennium.
The logistical and intellectual magnitude of that effort, particularly around Samya Monastery during the imperial translation projects, it really cannot be overstated. I mean, Sanskrit is a highly inflected, structurally fluid language. It's capable of immense philosophical poetry.
Right.
And Tibetan at that time had to be molded to hold that weight. So Vidyakara Prabha and Bande Yeshe Ningpo had to ensure that the exact mechanism of liberation encoded in the Sanskrit wasn't lost in the Tibetan syntax.
Because the stakes are incredibly high for them.
Oh, the highest possible stakes. They were operating with the understanding that a mistranslation could literally delay the enlightenment of countless beings.
Wow.
The sheer gravity of their task is awe-inspiring. And, you know, we must extend that same deep appreciation to the modern translation team from the Alexander Chrysoma de Kuros translation group. Scholars like Zusa Major, Karma Dorje, Beata Kakas, and Nathaniel Rich working under the 84,000 Project.
Right, because they've carefully navigated that Tibetan to bring this vital beating heart of a text into English for you today.
Precisely.
But there is a massive scholarly mystery surrounding this document, isn't there?
There is, yes.
If you look at the architecture of the Degye Kangyur, this text sits in the General Sutra section, and it acts as a pair with another text, To 285, the Dedication Fulfilling All Aspirations. Both of these texts seem designed to act as seals, sort of closing out major sections of Mahayana Sutras.
Right.
But there's a glaring anomaly. I mean, anyone who has ever opened a traditional Buddha Sutra knows the rhythm. It almost always begins with the phrase, "Thus did I hear at one time," followed by a rich, detailed description of where the Buddha was.
Like Vulture Peak Mountain, yeah.
Exactly. And it lists the exact vast assembly of monks, nuns, and bodhisattvas gathered around him. But Toll 286 has absolutely none of that. It just starts.
It does. The total absence of a Nidana, which is that traditional narrative introduction, is fascinating to scholars. It immediately signals that this text was either severed from its original narrative body, or it was designed differently from the very start.
Has anyone figured out which one it is?
Well, the great 15th century Tibetan scholar Paikar Sangpo analyzed this very anomaly, and he concluded that it must be an extract from a much larger comprehensive sutra that was either lost to time or just never fully translated into Tibetan.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. And modern scholarship has yet to find a parent text in any extant Sanskrit manuscripts or Chinese translations. So it just floats in the canon, unmoored from a narrative setting.
Which raises an immediate practical issue for you, the practitioner. If it lacks that narrative framing, if there's no story of a disciple asking the Buddha a question to orient the listener, how is a practitioner supposed to navigate the flow of it? I mean, does it follow another recognizable architectural structure from the tradition?
It does, actually. While it lacks the narrative frame of a sutra, it bears the structural shadow of a classic liturgical sequence known as the Seven Branches, or Yan Lagbi Dumpa in Tibetan.
Okay, the Seven Branches.
Yes. For those of you who engage in daily Mahayana or Vajrayana practice, you know this rhythm intimately. The Seven Branches are a psychological technology designed to purify the mind and accumulate merit.
Can you listen for us?
Sure, they are. Prostration, offering, confession, rejoicing in the virtue of others, requesting the Buddhas to teach, requesting them not to pass into Nirvana, and finally, dedicating the merit.
Right. But when I read through this text to prepare for this deep dive, I didn't see all seven of those branches explicitly laid out.
You are correct. And that is precisely what makes it so historically significant. It only features a few of those branches: prostration, confession, rejoicing, supplication, and dedication.
So it skips offering and requesting them to remain.
Completely. To modern practitioners, it looks incomplete. But to textual scholars, this strongly suggests that this profound dedication was composed and utilized before the seven-branch liturgy was fully formalized into the rigid, codified structure that became standard in later centuries.
Wow.
It possesses this ancient elemental rawness.
It feels like standing in a cathedral before the stained glass and the final arches were installed, you know? You are looking at the raw foundation stones of Mahayana practice.
That's a beautiful way to put it.
And knowing this, we can now open the text itself and look at how the author prepares your mind for the staggering, universe-shifting dedication that comes later. It begins with the opening homage. The text says, "I prostrate to the Buddha, to the teaching, and to the entire assembly. Blessed Buddhas and all Bodhisattva great beings, please pay heed to me."
We should pause immediately at that invocation of Bodhisattva great beings, because the text demands that we understand exactly who we are calling upon.
Right. What does that term actually mean?
We often translate Bodhisattva simply as an awakened being, but the etymology offers a much deeper instruction. In Sanskrit, Bodhi means awakening or enlightenment, and Sattva is often translated as being, but it also carries the strong connotation of courage, spiritual essence, or heroic intention.
So a bodhisattva isn't just someone who sits and meditates a lot. The word implies a kind of warrior.
Exactly. A spiritual warrior. Historically, the emergence of the bodhisattva ideal marked a radical shift in the Buddhist tradition. It moved the goalpost of spiritual practice from personal liberation, you know, escaping the cycle of samsara just for oneself, to the heroic, almost unimaginable vow to refuse ultimate peace until every single other sentient being is liberated first.
It's overwhelming commitment.
It is. They are beings entirely driven by bodhicitta, the mind of awakening. And a bodhisattva, great being, or mahasattva, refers to those who have traversed the absolute deepest levels of this path. They are beings of immense, unshakable realization.
So when the reciter says, "Please pay heed to me," they are doing something very intense.
Yes. It is an act of profound vulnerability. You are calling the most compassionate, powerful witnesses in the universe to observe the state of your mind.
You are stepping right into the spotlight of their omniscient awareness. And once you have their attention, You move right into paragraph 1.3, which lays out four foundational acts.
Let's hear them.
The text says, I confess all sins. I rejoice in all merits. I pray to all Buddhas. I dedicate all merits so that all sentient beings attain the unsurpassed wisdom of omniscience.
We really must be precise with the terminology here because these are not casual religious platitudes. The text aims for omniscience, which in Tibetan is Thamskad Minkyenpa.
Omniscience usually makes people think of a creator god, right?
Yes. In a Western context, omniscience often implies a creator deity knowing the data of everything that happens, you know, knowing what you had for breakfast.
Right.
But in Buddhist epistemology, Thamskad Kinpa is the state of Buddhahood itself. It is the direct, unmediated realization of the ultimate and conventional nature of all phenomena simultaneously, without the slightest cognitive distortion. It is total awakening.
And the fuel for reaching that state is merit, or blightsad names. I think merit is one of the most misunderstood concepts for Western practitioners.
Oh, absolutely.
It often gets reduced to a kind of spiritual currency, like you're racking up frequent flyer miles so you can buy a better rebirth. But it's much more dynamic than that, isn't it?
It is entirely dynamic. Merit Bidsad Nams is not a static currency at all. It is the positive karmic momentum generated by virtuous actions of body, speech, and mind.
So it's an active force.
Think of it as a localized restructuring of your reality. Every time you act with genuine generosity or patience, you are fundamentally altering the neural and karmic pathways of your being. You are generating a vital force that physically and mentally propels you toward clarity.
To visualize why these specific four acts, confession, rejoicing, praying, dedicate, are grouped together here, I want to use an agricultural analogy.
Yeah, I'd like that.
Think of your mind as a field. If you want to grow the massive, universe-spanning tree of universal compassion, you cannot just throw the seed onto hard, unworked earth. You have to prepare the soil.
Right.
First, you must pull the weeds. That is confession. You have to painfully acknowledge the toxic roots, the defensive habits, and the harmful actions you've allowed to take over. Next, you must fertilize the soil. That is rejoicing in the merit of others.
That is a crucial step to highlight. Rejoicing is the direct antidote to jealousy and competitiveness, which are honestly the most insidious hardeners of the soil. By genuinely celebrating the goodness of others, your mind becomes incredibly expansive and rich.
Exactly. Then, once the soil is cleared and enriched, you need rain. You look up and ask for the water to fall. That is praying to the Buddhas, opening yourself to external boundless blessings rather than relying solely on your own isolated effort.
Beautiful.
And finally, you plant the seed, that is the dedication of merit, you gather all that cultivated, vibrant energy, and you point it in one specific direction, the awakening of all beings.
And this preparation, we have to emphasize, is psychologically mandatory.
Why is that?
If you attempt the radical dedication that is coming in the later sections of this text, while your mind is still in its default, untrained state, you know, tight, defensive, obsessed with its own survival, the words will just be an empty intellectual performance.
The ego will just reject it.
Instantly, the ego will block the profound vulnerability required. These four acts dismantle the ego's defenses methodically, leaving the mind soft, open, and capable of generating true, selfless aspiration.
So the field is prepped. And you might expect the text to immediately shower you with beautiful visualizations of light and peace.
But it doesn't.
It doesn't at all. Instead, it forces you to look at the mud. The text requires you, the practitioner, to gaze unflinchingly at the staggering reality of human suffering and delusion.
It refuses to look away. In paragraph 1.4, the author constructs a towering, cascading catalog of the faults and miseries burdening sentient beings, or seems can.
Yeah.
The text states that beings are bound and fettered by obscurations, which in Tibetan is skribapa. This term literally means a veil, a covering, or a stain that blocks the light of our true nature.
And it names four specific types, right?
Yes. Afflictive obscurations, karmic obscurations, ripened obscurations, and cognitive obscurations. We must dedicate time to understanding each of these, as they are the exact chains we are promising to break.
Let's do that. Let's look at the actual anatomy of what keeps us trapped. Starting with afflictive obscurations, what exactly are those?
Afflictive obscurations, or kleshas, are our destructive emotions. This is the heat of our neuroses. It is the immediate, visceral arising of anger, greed, intense jealousy, or pride.
So it's the stuff we feel right in our chest.
Psychologically, yes. These are the emotional states that agitate the mind, stripping it of its natural clarity and forcing it into reactive, defensive postures. When you lose your temper or become consumed by envy, you are entirely wrapped in an afflictive obscuration.
It's the emotional fire. And that fire naturally leads to action, which brings us to the second type, karmic obscurations.
Ew.
If the affliction is the anger, the karmic obscuration is what happens when I act on that anger.
Precisely. Karmic obscurations are the deep, latent imprints left on your mind stream by the harmful actions of body, speech, and mind that you committed while under the influence of those afflictions.
So the action itself leaves a mark.
Always. If anger causes you to speak cruel words, the sound of the words fades, but the karmic imprint is stamped into your consciousness. It is a seed planted in the dark, waiting for the right conditions to sprout. This obscuration binds you to future suffering because the momentum of that action will inevitably pull you toward a corresponding result.
And when that seed finally does sprout, we experience the third type, ripened obscurations.
Yes. The ripened obscuration is the actual manifestation of that karma. It is the lived reality of suffering.
What does that look like?
It might manifest physically as being born into an environment devoid of spiritual opportunity or experiencing chronic illness or deep poverty. Or it might manifest mentally as a mind plagued by relentless anxiety or depression. It is the heavy, inescapable consequence of past afflictions and actions finally coming to term.
Those three make intuitive sense to me. The emotion, the action, and the consequence.
Nah.
But the fourth one, the cognitive obscuration, always strikes me as the most insidious. The text separates it from the emotional heat of the afflictions.
It is the most subtle and the most deeply rooted. Cognitive obscurations, or jina avaranta, do not feel hot or agitated like anger. They are cold, structural, and foundational.
How so?
This is the fundamental dualistic ignorance that superimposes a sense of inherent, independent existence onto reality. It is the mechanism that constantly divides the world into a solid subject me and a solid object, everything else. Even in a moment of emotional calm, when you are perfectly peaceful, if you still perceive yourself as fundamentally separate from the universe, you are bound by cognitive obscurations. They are the subtle veils that block omniscience.
The text says that because beings are wrapped in these four obscurations, they live in profound ignorance. The list of what we fail to see is just tragic.
It is.
The text says, beings fail to know their own intrinsic nature. They fail to understand their latent dispositions or the basic constituents of reality. They fail to encounter holy beings or listen to the Dharma or practice correctly. They are literally sleepwalking through eternity. And while they are sleepwalking, they fall right into the trap of worldly thoughts.
The author provides a devastatingly accurate psychological profile of a mind trapped in samsara here. It lists the specific desires that consume our energy.
And this is where the text feels so incredibly modern. It's almost unsettling.
Let's hear it.
This is a manuscript from a millennium ago, yet it warns against the wish for gain, the wish to be honored, the wish for fame, and the wish for followers. The wish for followers. When I read that, I had to stop. That is the exact anxiety driving the entire social media ecosystem today.
It is striking, isn't it?
We have built global technological infrastructures explicitly designed to exploit the very worldly thoughts this test identified centuries ago. We are still trapped by the exact same cravings.
Human technology has evolved, but the fundamental architecture of the unawakened human ego remains identical. The ego constantly seeks external validation, honor, fame, followers, to prove its own existence.
Right.
The text goes on to list toxic thoughts. Desire, malevolence, violence, and even an obsession with immortality.
You know, I do want to push back on one part of this list.
Yeah.
Because it's a point where modern readers often misinterpret the Dharma.
Shouldn't they do?
The text warns against thoughts of desire regarding the requisites of life. Clothing, food, bedding, and medicine. Someone listening might think, wait, is this text saying that having food or medicine is inherently bad? Is it a spiritual failing to seek a doctor when I'm sick or to want a warm bed for my children?
That is a critical distinction to make because it touches the very core of the Buddha's middle way. The Buddhist view has never taught that basic necessities are evil or that extreme physical deprivation leads to enlightenment.
Right. The Buddha rejected extreme fasting.
He famously abandoned extreme asceticism because starving the body only agitated the mind. The text here is absolutely not targeting the objects themselves. The food or the medicine. It is targeting our obsession, our clinging, and our desperate psychological attachment to them.
It's the difference between eating to nourish your body so you can practice and hoarding resources out of a terrified belief that your physical comfort is the ultimate meaning of existence.
Exactly. When we view physical survival or luxury as the pinnacle of human achievement, we generate immense negative karma. greed, theft, violence, systemic exploitation, just to defend and accumulate those resources.
We completely lose our way.
We lose complete sight of our intrinsic nature. The text draws a direct causal line from this obsessive clinging to the immense suffering it describes next.
The text states that because we are trapped in these obsessions, beings experience short lives, ill health, bad complexions, low status, stupidity, and rebirth in lower realms, such as hell beings, animals, or in the realm of the Lord of the Dead.
And we must understand this not as a divine punishment handed down by an angry judge, but as the natural tragic physics of karma.
Cause and effect.
Yes. If a mind contracts into tight, selfish grasping and aggression in this life, it naturally propels itself into a state of existence, a lower realm, that perfectly mirrors that tightness and fear in the next.
So as a practitioner engaging with this text, you have just spent a significant amount of your meditation session visualizing this towering mountain of human suffering. You've brought to mind the structural ignorance, the desperate craving for followers, the hoarding, the physical illness, the lower realms.
Your mind is saturated.
Completely saturated with the sheer agony of the Caesaric condition. And this is where the text pulls the rug out from under you. What do you do with all this negativity? If you just sit with the weight of the world's pain, it feels like it would crush you into despair.
It would.
But here, the text makes its breathtaking pivot. We reach the absolute climax of the dedication.
Yes. The text has built this tension methodically. It brings you to the very precipice of existential despair regarding the cycle of suffering. And then, instead of offering an escape hatch, it demands the ultimate alchemy.
I want to read this quote slowly. Please, as you listen, let the weight of these words land. After enumerating all the horrors and obscurations of sentient beings, the reciter does not ask for protection from them. The reciter declares, "May everything that will ripen for sentient beings obscured and fettered by these and any other obscurations ripen for me, and may all sentient beings thus be liberated and purified."
It is a staggering, terrifying aspiration.
I feel it in my chest just reading it.
To fully appreciate the magnitude of what the practitioner is doing here, we need to understand the core practice this represents. This is the essence of Blospyam, the Tibetan tradition of mind training. And specifically, it is the scriptural foundation for the practice of Gultong Len, which translates to giving and taking.
For those who might not be familiar with the actual mechanics of Gultong Len, how does it work in practice?
In formal Diltong Len meditation, the practitioner synchronizes their visualization with their breath. As you inhale, you visualize taking on the suffering, the pain, the illness, and the negative karma of others, often visualizing it as a thick, hot, black smoke that you draw directly into your own heart.
Wow.
And as you exhale, you visualize giving away all of your own merit, joy, health, wealth, and enlightenment to others, usually radiating it outwards as brilliant, cooling white light. You are actively inhaling the world's poison and exhaling your own life force.
And as we touched on at the beginning, the historical and scholarly significance of finding this explicitly written here in this ancient canonical text is massive.
It cannot be overstated. The Kangyur contains the translated words of Buddha spanning thousands of pages of sutras and tantras, and the spirit of compassion is, of course, everywhere. But scholars have pointed out that this tiny, hitherto unnoticed dedication contains practically the only explicit scriptural articulation of this exact mechanic.
The actual taking on of the suffering.
The precise, unambiguous wish that the suffering of others ripens on oneself. Usually, this radical idea is found in later commentaries, like the works of the great Indian master Shantideva, or the specific Blospyam lineages popularized centuries later in Tibet by Atisha and Geshe Chikawa.
But here it is.
Here it is, sitting quietly in a canonical sutra translation from the imperial period. This text is the ancient scriptural root for centuries of Tibetan practice.
It is so completely counterintuitive to everything our biology and our culture teaches us.
Mm.
Usually when we pray, whether in a Buddhist context, a Christian context, or any other tradition, we are fundamentally asking for a shield.
Yes, protection.
We are saying, please keep the suffering away from me. Protect my family. Keep us safe from the storm. But this text asks you to drop the shield entirely. It asks you to walk out into the storm and become a lightning rod, drawing the agonizing strike away from others and directly into your own chest. May it ripen for me.
It is the ultimate subversion of our survival instinct.
But practically speaking, I have to ask, how does a practitioner actually do this mentally without going insane or being completely crushed by empathetic despair? I mean, I sit on my cushion and truly, vividly imagine taking on the cancer of a dying child, the depression of a suicidal friend, the starvation of entire nations. It feels annihilating. My mind just screams in terror.
And it should scream.
It should.
Yes. That terror is exactly the point. That is the genius and the profound paradox of Wo Dan Lin. It is annihilating. But what it annihilates is not your true nature. It annihilates the ego.
Explain that mechanism for me. How does taking on pain destroy the ego?
Well, the ego is the persistent illusion of a separate, independent self that needs to be defended at all costs. The terror you feel when you imagine breathing in the world's cancer is simply the ego terrified of its own destruction. It is the ego saying, if I take this on, I will cease to exist. But Buddhist psychology reveals that this very ego, this obsessive, self-cherishing mind, is the actual root cause of all our sansaric suffering. By voluntarily, courageously choosing to take on the suffering of others, you are launching a direct strike at the very heart of self-cherishing.
You're starving the ego of its favorite food, self-protection.
Exactly. When you continuously breathe in the suffering of others, the illusion of separation begins to collapse. You realize that self and other are profoundly interconnected. And when that tight, fearful boundary of the ego dissolves, what rushes in to fill the vacuum is not despair.
What is it?
It is boundless, unshakable compassion. You discover that compassion is not a fragile, bleeding heart emotion that can be crushed by the weight of the world. It is the ultimate armor. It is the vast, spacious nature of the mind itself, capable of holding everything without breaking.
So by inviting the poison in, you realize you are not a tiny cup of water that will be ruined by a drop of ink. You realize you are the ocean. And when the poison hits the ocean, it simply dissolves.
That is a perfect metaphor.
And that realization, that radical shift from the fragile self to the boundless ocean, is what launches the text into its next movement. Having made this monumental vow to absorb the suffering of sentient beings, practitioner's mind is completely blown open, and the text immediately zooms out from the scale of individual beings to the fundamental fabric of reality itself. We move into paragraph 1.5.
Having broken the boundary of the self, the reciter's mind is now vast enough to contemplate the ultimate nature of phenomena. The text invokes various elements.
Which worms?
It mentions the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha elements. It mentions the elements of the three poisons we discussed: desire, anger, and ignorance. And then, crucially, it invokes profound philosophical states to establish the sheer scale of the dedication.
Let's unpack these states, because the terminology here is deeply mystical.
Yeah.
And for a practitioner, these are pointers to the ultimate truth.
Right.
The text mentions suchness, which is the bizin ni. It mentions sameness, nyampai nid, and the very limit of reality, yangdag paimta. Now, when I read the term suchness, my Western materialist mind immediately jumps to things as they physically are, like the wood of this desk or the biology of a tree. But I know in Mahayana philosophy, it's much more subversive than that. Am I right in thinking this is about stripping away our conceptual labels?
You are absolutely right. Suchness does not refer to the physical atomic structure of things. It refers to reality just as it is, entirely stripped of our conceptual projections, our linguistic labels, and our dualistic judgments.
Give me an example.
When you look at a tree, you instantly apply 1,000 concepts. It's an oak, it's green, it's useful for lumber, it's mine. Suchness is the raw, unconstructed, inexpressible nature of the phenomenon before the mind chops it into pieces.
Okay, and how does realizing sameness build upon that?
Sameness, nampai nid, is the profound realization of emptiness applied universally. It is the understanding that in ultimate reality, all phenomena are equal in their lack of inherent, independent existence.
They are equally empty.
Exactly. A beautiful flower and a pile of garbage are the same in that neither possesses an independent, unchanging essence. More radically, it means there is no fundamental, ultimate difference between self and other, or even between samsara and nirvaya. They are equal in their emptiness.
That's a huge leap.
It is. And realizing the sameness completely destroys the ego, because the ego relies on the absolute difference between me and you to survive.
And the very limit of reality.
The Yangdag Paimita is the absolute boundary where all conceptual proliferation ceases entirely. It is the ultimate expense of truth. The text is invoking these concepts to say, to the exact infinite extent of suchness, sameness, and the very limit of reality, as vast and boundless as ultimate reality itself is, to that very extent, may the afflictions of beings ripen on me.
It scales the compassion up for the human level to the level of the infinite. And then, in paragraph 1.6, it addresses the scale of time. It talks about dedicating roots of virtue accumulated from cyclic existence's undiscoverable beginning. Cyclic existence is samsara, the endless cycle of birth and death. And roots of virtue are the fundamental seeds of goodness and merit we have planted through right action over lifetimes.
What is incredibly beautiful and poignant in this paragraph is the sudden, profound humility of the practitioner. After making this cosmic, reality-bending vow, the reciter suddenly admits their own sheer limitation.
What do they say?
They say, I do not correctly know, see, or understand how to dedicate the roots of virtue, but the blessed Buddhas do know. I dedicate them in accordance with the mind of the Tathagatas. A Tathagata is an epithet for a Buddha, meaning one who has thus gone, or one who has thus come to the ultimate truth.
I genuinely struggle with the sheer scale of this when I sit down to practice. If cyclic existence has an undiscoverable beginning, the volume of time we are talking about is totally incomprehensible to the human brain.
Unfathomable.
We are talking about billions of lifetimes, an absolute eternity of past actions. How can a single practitioner, sitting on a meditation cushion on a Tuesday morning, actively dedicate something so vast that their mind can't even perceive it? It feels like trying to pour the Pacific Ocean through a tiny plastic funnel. The physics don't work.
The conceptual physics don't work, which is exactly why the text provides a different mechanism. This is where we must deeply understand the concept of lineage, refuge, and the nature of an awakened mind.
Okay, how does that solve it?
You are absolutely right. Our conceptual dualistic minds cannot hold the undiscoverable beginning. But a Buddha's omniscient mind operates outside of linear time. It holds all of it simultaneously.
So how do we bridge that gap?
By admitting our limitation, I do not correctly know, and actively surrendering our dedication to the mind of the Tathagatas. This is a profound spiritual technology. We can think of it using the ancient metaphor of Indra's net.
Oh, I love that metaphor.
It's a vast cosmic web where at every intersection there is a jewel, and every jewel reflects every other jewel in the net infinitely. By aligning our pure intention with the awakened, omniscient minds of all past, present, and future Buddhas, our limited, localized dedication instantly partakes in their infinite dedication.
We are essentially piggybacking on their omniscience.
Yes. Your drop of water merges with their ocean. The moment it merges, your drop no longer exists as a separate, limited entity. It becomes the ocean. You don't need an intellectual map of eternity. You just need perfect, surrendered alignment with the awakened mind.
That is a staggering relief for a practitioner. You don't have to figure out the logistical spreadsheets of saving the universe. You just have to align your heart perfectly with those who already know the way. And that alignment brings us down from the cosmos right back into the grit of everyday reality. Because we've aligned our minds with the Buddhas, but how does this esoteric cosmic dedication translate into actual real-world action? The text provides an astoundingly diverse toolkit for how to help others in paragraph 1.4, reviewing the methods of taming beings.
In Buddhist terminology, taming, or duldaba, does not mean dominating, suppressing, or domesticating someone. It means guiding a wild, afflicted, suffering mind toward peace and realization. It is the active application of compassion.
And the contrast the text lists are fascinating. Let me read the specific pairs of how compassion acts in the world. The text says, we tame beings. Taming gently versus taming wrathfully. Taming with equanimity versus taming threateningly. Taming by exorcism versus taming by means of acts of service. Taming by explaining the Dharma versus taming by simply smiling. Taming by going into seclusion versus taming by having few possessions. It also mentions taming through the six perfections.
Let us briefly anchor ourselves in the six perfections, the paramitas, which are the foundational activities of a bodhisattva in the world.
Yes, what are they?
They are generosity, giving without any attachment, ethical discipline, living without harming others, endurance or patience, bearing hardship and insult without anger, diligence, joyful, relentless effort in virtue, meditative absorption, one-pointed concentration, and wisdom, the direct realization of emptiness. Every single act of taming must be infused with these six.
I am particularly zeroed in on one pair here. Taming by smiling, paired with taming wrathfully.
Wow.
This completely shatters the Western stereotype of a Buddhist teacher or a practitioner, just sitting serenely on a cushion, always speaking in a soft whisper, never raising their voice.
It does.
This implies that true compassion is completely shape-shifting. Sometimes it looks like a warm smile, and sometimes it looks like a fierce, threatening reprimand. But I have to push back here. Because historically, crazy wisdom and wrathful intervention have frequently been used as convenient excuses for abuse by spiritual teachers. How does a practitioner or a student know the difference between true skillful means and a teacher just having an ego-driven temper tantrum?
That is the most crucial question we can ask regarding this text. This brings us to the profound and incredibly demanding doctrine of upaya, or skillful means. True compassion is not a fixed personality trait.
Right.
It is not about a practitioner maintaining a comfortable self-image of being nice or spiritual. In fact, insisting on always being gentle when a student regently needs a firm wake-up call is a subtle form of self-cherishing.
How so?
You are protecting your own comfort and your self-image rather than serving their liberation.
So the method used isn't about the teacher at all.
Exactly. Skillful means dictates that the method used is determined 100% by what the student's obscurations require in that exact, unrepeatable moment. If a mind is thick with arrogant pride and aggression, perhaps only a wrathful intervention will pierce the veil. If a mind is terrified and fragile, only a gentle smile will open it.
But how do we guarantee it isn't abuse?
The absolute prerequisite for wrathful, skillful means is the complete, genuine absence of self-interest and personal anger in the teacher. If there is even a trace of the teacher's ego wanting to control, punish, or dominate for their own satisfaction, it is not skillful means. It is just Caesaric harm.
So the teacher has to be entirely empty of personal agenda.
Yes. A true bodhisattva strips away their own personal preference and becomes a flawless mirror, manifesting whatever energy the sentient being needs to see their own awakened nature. If the mirror needs to reflect fire to burn away ignorance, it reflects fire, but the mirror itself does not burn.
That requires a level of realization that is staggering to contemplate, and that perfect adaptability flows seamlessly into the conclusion of the text. The dedication concludes by moving from the internal mind of the practitioner completely out into the world, offering the reciter up as a pure instrument for the universe. Let's listen to the final vows in paragraphs 1.7 and 1.8. The reciter prays, "May sentient beings see me in whatever manner will tame them without their having any such thoughts in mind. And may I always engage in physical, verbal, and mental actions in whatever ways sentient beings will be purified."
And it concludes with the ultimate aspiration in 1.8. In whatever time, whatever place, and whatever way sentient beings will be tamed, may the sphere of reality be thus revealed to them without confusion.
The sphere of reality.
Yes. The sphere of reality, or Chöske Dabhyāṅgas, often translated from Sanskrit as the Dharmadhatu, is the ultimate, all-encompassing expanse of emptiness and luminosity. It is the space where all phenomena naturally arise and dissolve, completely free from the distortions of the four obscurations we discussed earlier.
I am so struck by the specific phrasing in that vow, without their having any such thoughts in mind. The practitioner is praying to help beings to manifest as whatever they need, a smile, a rebuke, an act of service, without the beings even realizing they're being helped by a practitioner.
Yes.
It is the absolute peak of anonymity and selflessness. The people you are saving don't even need to know your name. They don't need to say thank you. They don't even need to know that Buddhism exists. It's the highest form of altruism, completely severed from any demand for gratitude or recognition.
It is the ultimate vanishing act of the ego. If we synthesize the entire journey of this magnificent text, we see a flawless psychological and spiritual progression.
Let's trace it.
We started by preparing the soil through confession and rejoicing. We moved into an overwhelming, almost crushing confrontation with the darkest human flaws and obscurations. We made the courageous, radical vow to take that suffering upon ourselves, destroying the illusion of a separate self in the process. We aligned our limited minds with the infinite minds of the Buddhas, and we end here with the practitioner dissolving entirely. You no longer exist as a needy, grasping ego demanding thanks for your spiritual work. You become an anonymous, adaptable, shape-shifting force for universal awakening, working tirelessly so that the sphere of reality is revealed to all beings without confusion.
It is a complete, profound blueprint for radically reorienting one's existence. In just a few short pages, the text takes you from the absolute depths of Caesaric despair to the heights of omniscient compassion.
And we must remind ourselves, and you who are listening, that this isn't just a beautiful philosophical theory. This text is a liturgy. It is meant to be recited daily, to be felt in the nervous system, and to be lived in the grit of the world. True protection of beings, as the title Protecting All Beings demands, comes only from our willingness to bear their burdens without asking for anything in return.
Thank you for joining us in this slow, reverent space today. We hope this deep dive into Tom 286 has provided fertile soil for your own practice and given you a glimpse into the profound depths of the Tibetan canonical tradition. As we close, I want to leave you with a final paradox to meditate on as you step back into the stream of your day. This text asks you to do the unthinkable, to take on the heavy, agonizing suffering of every living being. It asks you to become the lightning rod for the world's pain. But in doing so, consider what is actually happening. Do you actually destroy your own deepest source of suffering, the isolated, fearful, grasping ego? Take a breath and ask yourself, what if choosing to willingly carry the heaviest burden in the universe is, ironically, the only way to become truly light?
Authentic Tibetan Teachings and Transcripts from BodhiArchive.org.